G'day punters and welcome to another episode of the Tripod Wide World of Punting. This is episode 3 and today, it's a pretty good episode today. Actually, we're going to recap State of Origin Game 2. It's come down to a live rubber decider. We're also going to talk a little bit about the US Masters that starts tonight, our time. Jacob's got a Wide World bet of the week. We cashed our one last week at over $3 odds. And then at the end of the episode, we're going to have about a 20-minute chat to the guy that's been blowing up in the group, Jake Humphreys, about his tennis betting and how he finds value betting futures and also individual games. Jacob, how are you, mate?
Not too bad, thanks, mate. After Origin 1, our best bet lost, but our state won.
Correct.
And tonight, we're going to talk about our state losing, and it wasn't too close, but our best bet cashed at least. Let's start there. Over 6.5
Indeed.
Tries we had. I think there were 8 tries. And firstly, let me say, the better team played better and won
that game.
New South Wales really had to. But back to the tries over, for me, it came down to the style that the footy was played. Clearly suited New South Wales. Less stop-start, more open game, less of the arm wrestle that game one was. And, you know, you go back to game one, one of the things that people said Queensland did so well was controlled with their kicking game and DC and Munster. But what you have to understand is these halves don't choose when they're going to have a good kicking game. It really is all predicated on winning the ruck. New South Wales came out and picked 4 forwards on the bench. It was clear, you know, that they wanted to win the ruck, have more energy, win in the kick chase, you know, win the territory battle. And they did that.
Yeah, they definitely did. And we mentioned that in the preview pod that, you know, picking 4 forwards on the bench with no utility, you know, some people might have said risky. We liked the move because, you know, State of Origin is always that faster-paced game, you know, and you kind of, obviously New South Wales thought it would be reffed as it was in Game 2, which was more 6-agains, a bit of a faster, more open game. And that, you know, lends itself to having a few extra forwards that are going to get tired, you know, on the bench. And they made a difference, you know, like guys like Isaiah Yeo were busting tackles second half. You know, we should rewind to like the first 5 minutes because obviously, you know, Munster got knocked out, didn't come back on. He passed the HIA, but then upon replay, they couldn't let him back on because he was a little bit wobbly. And not going to say that changed the outcome of the game, but obviously, you know, then Ben Hunt comes in and it did change the complexion of the game. But I thought there was a couple of things that the Blues improved on. Obviously, the forwards I thought were really good, and it really reminded me of what I've been saying about the Panthers during the regular season. It was just like the Blues are making more meters than Queensland. You're able to get Cleary kicking, you know, in good field position. And then the opposite was true for Queensland. You had Ben Hunt and Daly Cherry Evans kicking from inside their own half with kick pressure, and it really didn't suit them. So I thought, you know, New South Wales did a good job here. I thought Teddy looked a little bit better. We said he was missing that burst game one. I think he'd, you know, obviously fitness had improved for game two, but, you know, they were just way too good in this one. And honestly, this is pretty much the game we expected, wasn't it?
Well, there were a couple of question marks, I guess, which just kept us off New South Wales. We said we leant that way with the line, but the line had also moved through 8, and I think by kickoff again yesterday, it was double digits. And those question marks got answered. I mean, Nathan Cleary, he'd had a couple of subpar games for sure in the NRL Grand Final and Origin 1. And, you know, everyone was pointing out he's never actually been outstanding at Origin level. And his individual stats are pretty crazy. He'd never had even a line break assist, you know, or a try assist or a try or anything like that.
Yep.
And he's been in the team the last 2 years when they've won the series. Not like he's playing in a bunch of blowout losses. And then he comes out and, you know, has his best game at Origin level in that arena and gets man of the match and very deserving. Although right there with him was Cody Walker, who last time he started an Origin game, got dragged during the game. They lost. He was dropped. And then New South Wales came back and won. So, like, he really needed to step up and have a good game. He did. He was sensational. And Teddy, I thought Ted, there was nothing wrong with what Teddy did in game one. You know, it's just that we expect greatness out of him. But it was a captain's knock from him for sure. He was fantastic. Now, and you mentioned Munster. Now, for sure, losing, like, arguably your best player 2 minutes in is very rough. That could happen to any player at any time, and you could lose him for the rest of the game. And it was hard for Queensland to recover. I will say a wrinkle, though. I mean, that means he's going to be fresh for the decider, in all seriousness. Like, he's played all the way up to the grand final. We know he's dealt with a couple of knee injuries this year. And basically, he made one play in catching that bomb and then hit his head, which is unfortunate. But the fact that you mentioned it's come out today, he did not actually fail the HIA.
Correct.
I think that's promising. He should be there for the decider.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. Like, it's like one of those things where he's obviously coming into camp pretty hungover, and played, you know, decent game one. Obviously, game two, very fresh, doesn't get anything. And then you look at his, you know, the concussion protocol, no contact until essentially two days before the game. So he's going to be fresh as. I totally agree with you. I think Cody Walker needs to retain his position there in the halves. We mentioned that he's, you know, a bit more of a kind of Jerome Luai style half, I guess, alongside Cleary. I think that really helped. And Cleary's kicking game was on point this one. And we wondered, you know, the Panthers had the most, you know, repeat sets or, you know, grubbers into the end goal during the regular season for repeat sets. And we didn't really see that in game one. But then this game, geez, his kicking was on point. What I will say is, you know, he was, you know, obviously kicking those through for Adokar, who's the fastest dude in the NRL. Philip Sammy is out of his depth there on the wing. He honestly is. And it's been a two-game sample size now. I've seen enough that I need to see. He cannot remain in the Queensland team. He's just jogging back for these balls, and Adokar's flying through. And that cost him a couple of times with repeat sets. And, you know, we don't have much depth in the position. Philip Sammy needs to get out of there. There needs to be someone else there. What about his cousin, Mulitalo? Ronaldo Mulitalo, let's bring him in. The guy knows how to score tries. I think he would be a better winger than Sammy. And I thought he was the worst player on Queensland's team, and it honestly cost them.
Jeez, maybe a bit harsh. I don't know. Is Mulitalo in the squad? I'm not sure. I know that Sammy was only in the team because Branko Lee couldn't play in game one or two with his injury, because Gagai would have actually had the wing spot. But then Gagai's done very well at centre, Origin Gags there. So, look, I think, you know, Adokar, we've actually seen Philip Sammy outrun Adokar in the NRL game once. But it's a different story when it's a planned kick and Adokar's got the head start where Sammy has to turn and chase. Adokar will make anyone look slow. I don't want you to be a victim of overreacting to try and find a reason why a team lost, because didn't you hear all the recap of Origin 1? Every expert had the same take. Oh, New South Wales played two centres out of position. And look, we said before game one, we didn't see Gutho as like a strength at right centre for New South Wales. But we didn't blame their loss on, you know, playing guys out of position. Because you go back to last year, New South Wales lost game one. And they had Josh Morris and Latrell Mitchell in the centres. And who did they go and pick in the centres when they won game two and three? Jack Whiten and Tom Trbojevic. And no one said, oh, you've got players out of position at centre.
I mean, yeah, we didn't say that.
Yeah, and I don't hear anybody saying that Whiten and Gutho were a problem last night. So it just seemed like an easy narrative to say it was because players were out of position. I mean, Kurt Capewell's not a centre. He's playing there for Queensland. The fact is, New South Wales has a stronger roster, but they needed to step up and be counted yesterday. They were. So I don't think they'll really change anything if they've got everyone available. I look, one last point would be like, what can Queensland change? I'm confident Munster will come back in. And as I said, we'll be fresh. I'm hopeful that Christian Welsh, who got the knock in game one, hopeful that he could play because he was really good in game one and they could have used him yesterday in the middle. I know Queensland won't pick Harry Grant. I'm kind of satisfied. Jake Friend was good in game one and he's earned that jersey for this series. And I think there's intangibles there, like his leadership and then the way that he glues the middle up. And I'm willing to understand that even though Queensland's highest upside might be Harry Grant, he can wait his turn. You know, he'll get plenty of opportunities. But of course, we'll preview the game more in depth on Sunday night, 7 p.m. That's a decider that we all deserve to end the footy season.
It is indeed. Should be a cracker. Are you going to go to that one, Jacob?
I'd love to go. I don't live in Brisbane anymore. I'm not sure if I can get a ticket or not, but either way, even though I'm disappointed Queensland lost, it's bloody, you know, it's grouse that we've got a decider.
Yeah, very true.
On Wednesday.
I heard the tickets are about $200 is the cheapest ticket, so it might be a little bit rough for us. Let's move on, Jacob, and obviously a big thing that's happening today, like I said, starting tonight, is the US Masters Golf Tournament kicks off, and a lot of people in the group obviously interested in golf, and honestly, like, we don't pretend to be betting experts on golf or anything like that, but I'll tell you what, it's a fun sport to bet on. Like, it goes for multiple days, you know, kind of like the election, you've got some ups and downs, you can follow the live betting. Are you going to be watching this one, Jacob? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, the Masters is kind of that unique event that even if you don't follow golf all year, you like can't help but be interested in it. I think you're saying tonight, but I believe, I mean, it's Thursday in the States, which will be Friday morning. So Aussie time for you guys viewing. I think from roughly 5 a.m. each morning, this is all going to kick off. And then it's probably going to go till, you know, mid-morning Aussie time, which is pretty good. If you're getting up before work, you watch a bit, or if you're tracking it along. And you said it, like, there's so many ways you can bet it. You don't just bet who you think's going to win the tournament and then sit back. There's all these different markets. There's, you know, pairing off players that are in groups, like head-to-heads. There's, you know, obviously all the different finishing brackets on the leaderboard and you know, round one, and even specifics like whether players are going to bogey or birdie certain holes and stuff. So it's awesome from a punting perspective. And as you said, we're not experts, but let's move to the wide world bet of the week.
Before I get to your wide world punt of the week, obviously we cashed our one last week. You've got one for the US Masters Golf. Like I said, I'm no betting expert on the golf, but what I just will say is if you're betting the outright winner, if you're betting top 10, top 20, top 30, stuff like that, where there's hundreds of different players that you can choose, the VIG or the bookie edge that you're going to pay on that is going to far outweigh, you know, how much you know about the golf tournament. So what I would suggest, even though I never bet golf, is that if you're looking for the best chance of winning money, maybe bet some of those head-to-head ones where there's essentially two options. You can get a player A and player B. Which one of those is going to win at $1.90? That's going to be your best bet to not lose a ton of money on the US Masters Golf. But Jacob, fire away your wide world bet of the week for week three.
Well, yeah, I'm going to always try and aim to make the wide world bet of the week something that's on the high-profile event for that week. And even though, as you say, we don't pretend to be experts, I'm not going to sit here and say the Masters is on and, like, try, you know, read up some golf facts and try and pretend like I follow it. But I'm going to use my punting knowledge, and my punting knowledge tells me to go on a deep dive and compare odds with everyone and try and find something that's at least reasonable odds that gives us a bit of interest. And this is the one I'm going to put my name to. As you said, you cashed UFC last week, $3.02 to Shera in the main event, right?
Correct.
So that's awesome stuff. And our Wide World Bet of the Week for episode one was a void because you basically quoted a market that didn't exist and got a bit excited. So here we are to back it up. I'm taking Webb Simpson to finish in the top 10. This is a 35-year-old American from North Carolina. He is the current number 7 in PGA rankings and 5th at the Masters last year. So I know he did okay. But the number one reason I'm betting him is not because I'm pretending to know that he's going to have a great tournament. It's because I've seen, when I was looking through all the markets, they had a lot of the players listed in the order of, you know, most favored to least favored.
Right.
And his odds were out of whack, where it was clear that his initial odds have dropped. And I love a market move.
Yes, yes.
So Webb Simpson, have you got the graphic up right now?
I do, I do.
Finished top 10, $4 odds on Unibet.
Very, very juicy. There you have it. Webb Simpson, $4 for top 10 on Unibet. Couple things I will add. Probably don't bet on Bryson DeChambeau. He's the favorite. This is just so tough for an $8.50 bet to be value in a field of, you know, over 100. And you know what else I find funny, Jacob? Wasn't Jordan Spieth, like, the best player in the world, like, not that long ago? The guy's $75 to win this tournament. Seems strange to me. But
well,
anyway.
Didn't Tiger win last year? And isn't he, like, 100-1?
Yeah, it's strange. So yeah, I mean, I don't follow sport. Anyway.
There you go.
All right, guys, that's it. Jacob's Wide World Bet of the Week. See if we can cash at some juicy odds 2 weeks in a row. So that's going to do it for us for this week, guys. But next up, if you're interested, we do have an interview with Jake Humphreys, who, if you're in the Tripod group on Facebook, you've noticed his bets. The guy is up well over 50 units within the last, you know, couple of months, betting not only individual matches and, you know, but mostly futures, and he finds value on futures like no other. So that's an interview we have coming up. If you're interested in that, then keep watching. If you're not interested in that, turn it off, and we will be back on Saturday morning to preview round 10 or week 10.
I mean, for people who are listening as a pod, did you say it's tennis, right?
Yeah.
So if people have been living under a rock, he's given tennis advice. You're the former tennis pro. You sat down with him. So give it a listen for a few minutes, see if it's for you. But because it's an in-depth interview, we chucked it at the end of the pod just so you know you don't have to hang around for the, you know, the Wide World Bet of the Week right at the end. We gave it to you up front, but I definitely suggest diving into this one to just get an insight of somebody other than us, how they take money off the bookies.
Absolutely. So look, enjoy that interview. We'll be back Saturday at noon for a preview of round 10 in the NFL, and then we'll be back next week, same time, for week 4 of Tripod Wide World of Punting. But enjoy our interview.
And Origin preview too.
And Origin preview.
Sunday night,
Origin Decider preview. But enjoy our interview with Jake Humphreys coming up next. Thanks, guys. All right, guys, we are here with the tennis maestro, the bloke that has been blowing up in the group, the hottest guy on tips over the last 2 to 3 months, futures betting whiz, cash out king, Jake Humphries. Did I miss anything, mate? How are you?
No, that was bang on. I'm good, mate. How you going?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. I have been excited to get you on, obviously, because, you know, I don't know if you know or not, but I used to play a little bit of tennis, but I'm not as good as you at the tennis side of things. So I was going to ask you, I haven't actually asked you before, did you used to play or what?
No, so my tennis career stretched to tennis camp as a 10-year-old, yep. And then beyond that, I didn't play ever. So I've learned way more about the technical side of things through watching it than playing it. I was far from a prodigy like yourself, according to Jacob. Yeah. But no, mate, I actually didn't go that deep into playing tennis at all. I kind of just learnt the majority of it through watching and reading, really. So, yeah.
Which probably isn't the worst thing, honestly, because, like, for myself, like, I played ever since I was, like, 5 till I was, like, 22. You know, like, 5 days a week, you know, like, hours far a day. Out. And then it's, like, I got to the end of it, and it's, like, I don't even want to look at a tennis ball anymore. I don't want to watch the matches. So that's why maybe I'm like not as into tennis betting as someone like you are. But like, how did you get into tennis betting in particular? Because you obviously bet other sports, but would you say that tennis is your best sport that you bet on?
Yeah, it's the best sport that I bet on. I don't know if I enjoy watching tennis as much as I enjoy watching NFL mm-hmm. or as much as I enjoy watching rugby league, but it just so happens that the lines aren't as sharp, what I mean? So I've obviously just had more success betting on tennis money-wise, and it's not even close.
Yeah.
And that's why I've gravitated towards that. And as you would know, the more you bet on something, the more inclined you are to watch it and really get around it. So, like, I was up this morning at 5 watching Red Zone. I love the NFL. Yep. It's probably my favourite sport to watch.
Yep.
But I'm betting against Vegas effectively there, whereas I don't know where these tennis lines are coming from, but some of them just are a bit loose, so that's kind of why I've gravitated towards tennis. Yeah,
because I was going to ask you as well, because obviously, like, our best sport is obviously the NRL, and like, I'll make sure that like I watch every single game, if not like, you know, rewatch a game over the weekend. There's only 8, but like for yourself, like there's tennis tournaments going on every day basically, like, and then mostly over in Europe or whatever, which is a completely different time zone, so like, you can't really find much time to watch it, can you? Like,
no. Well, unless you're staying up.
Well, that's right. Like, do you? Like, you know?
Yeah, man. Like, I reckon when the Euro swings like going, I work now as just a simple 9-to-5 job, and hopefully my boss doesn't see this, but I'm probably going to sleep sometimes at 4:30.
Jesus.
Getting up at 9, and then I'll maybe if I finish at 5, I'll squeak in that nap between like 6 and 8, I'm just capping tennis that's about to start. So, like, it's brutal on the body. But as you say, like, stats only tell so much of a story.
That's
like,
right.
you look at numbers, and I had a guy message me the other day, and he said, "Hey, mate, look, I really think I'm approaching this correctly. I've got this website here. I'm looking at these numbers. Why aren't I finding winners? Or why?" And it's just like, it just doesn't work like that.
Yeah,
stats don't show it. Stats don't show a net cord, or they don't show a mental breakdown or an umpire kerfuffle or whatever. Like, you've just got to be there and look at it. So,
100%.
Mate, I'm watching everything. Like, at the start of the Masters, I had 3 screens up, and I had 1 game on each screen, and I'm just, it's all tennis, man. Like, you've just got to immerse yourself in it.
I agree with you, and like, I always find the same thing with the NRL. Like, it's like, you can miss stuff if you don't watch the games and whatnot. So that's what I was going to ask you, because obviously there's obviously professional punters out there, not necessarily in tennis, but in like other sports or whatever, that won't even watch a game. You know, they'll just go completely off the stats and all the numbers, plug it into an algorithm or whatever, and bet. And I always find there's like, you know, it's like a bit of a combo of like what you see as an eye test and then some of the stats. But I guess from what you're saying, the amount of stuff that you watch, you'd say you're more of like an eye test punter than like a stats punter.
More so, I do fall back on the stats a lot to shore up my argument and just make sure that what I'm seeing is, I guess, accurate.
Like,
I go back and I say, hey, look, I feel like Tsitsipas is actually a low-key bad returner on the hard court. I see him spraying a lot of shots. He's not getting a lot of points in play. I don't like the way he's returning on the hard court. And then I'm thinking, is this true statistically? And I go to Tennis Abstract, and he's breaking well below average on the hard court. Mm-hmm. And I'm just making sure that I'm not actually watching with any sort of bias or anything like that. But I don't know, like, I cite stats a lot in what I'm writing, and I do think that they are very important. But I would probably skew it 60 eyes, 40 stats, you know what I mean? Yep. Like,
yeah, I agree, and it's like, I don't think, you know, I could never look at just the stats and form, like, you know, an educated opinion, because it's like, you watch these matches, and it's like, in whatever sport, and it's like, that team shouldn't have fucking won. And, you know, the stats could tell a completely different story of what happened on the field. And that was another thing I was going to ask you. So, obviously, like, you said you love the NFL and stuff like that, but you obviously do a lot better in your tennis betting. And I do wonder, like, do you find it easier to cap a tennis game because it's just literally one versus one? Like, it's just two players that you have to analyze rather than taking into account injuries and all the shit for dozens of players on a team or whatever.
Well, like, using the NRL as an example, like, yes, it's a team sport, and yes, there are, like, personnel variables, but, like, you know, every game's played on grass,
right?
Whether it's a good tour or a soft eight at Shark Park or whatever, yep. Like, it's all grass, it's all outdoors. Like, I find that, yes, even though tennis is only 1v1, like, there is a enormous difference between main court at the French Open and indoors at Paris 1000. Even though it's only 100%. Two people, mate, it's like, I cannot explain how much conditions, environment, surface, country, time zone, everything comes into it. And yep. Rugby league's only played in, you know, Sydney, Brisbane, New Zealand, Canberra, whatever.
Yep.
Tennis is everywhere. They had a bloody tournament in Kazakhstan last week.
Yeah.
So, like, you've got to be mindful of where it is and you know, who's jumped on a plane most recently and who's been there in the city earliest. Like, mate, yeah, so I get what you mean, but I still think that even though it's a one-on-one sport, an individual sport, all of the other elements and the factors make it as complex as capping an NFL or NRL game for sure.
Oh, I totally agree, and it's like, it reminds me of a time, and I think you could have bet on me, actually. I was traveling around, like, Europe, playing some futures tournaments and stuff for about 4 or 5 months.
ITF?
No, some futures, like, not juniors, but when I was, like, trying to be a pro, you know, late teens. And, like, I went all through Europe, played a bunch of tournaments in Greece, and, like, got my first ATP point. And then I was like, all right, I'm going to chase some more ATP points with a few of my buddies. We flew to Kuwait, which was just the biggest shithole I've ever been to. There was dust storms everywhere. It was boiling hot, over 40 degrees. And, like, I didn't want to be there. Like, there's dust swirling in my face when I was playing and stuff. And that's the sort of stuff that I guess you would look for, like, after, you know, traveling around for ages. Some of these guys, like, just, they're just worn out, you know?
100%. And at the end of a season, when you've got blokes like, I mean, using someone like Benoit Paire as an example, who I don't know if you know that. He's like a flashy French guy, woman, sort of bratty, likes his fashion, likes dressing up, likes his Lacoste clothes and stuff like that. He just seems like a guy who, at the end of the season, doesn't want to be playing in Astana, Kazakhstan.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right.
And, like, I'm happy to make that assessment. And he'll come up against a guy in, for example, he played a guy called Mikhail Kukushkin, who is a local, probably lives up the road. And that factor cannot be overstated, the fact that, like, one guy at the very end of the season is playing in a country that he's probably not too excited to get out and see the sights about. He's from Marseille or Paris or whatever, and I'm pretty sure he just wants to get back there and chuck his sunnies on and go down to the beach. You know? It's things like that that you just, mate, Tennis Abstract isn't going to have that.
Right, yeah, exactly, I mean?
Like,
exactly.
Like, not even close. So it's things like that that you've really got to be keyed in on it. It comes down to following players on Instagram, seeing what they're saying on their stories, on Twitter. Oh, mate, it's just, it's incredibly complex. It's everything, and that's what people don't really see with this ATP thing. They see the write-ups and the stakes and whatever, but, well, I couldn't tell you the hours I put into knowing these players, eh?
Bloody oath. It makes
ridiculous, mate.
It reminds me of a guy like Kyrgios, you know, like, if he's playing some shithole tournament, you know, in the middle of nowhere, he's most likely not going to be that motivated, but then come Grand Slam time, like, you know, you
big
kind of
player.
Know he's, yeah, he's going to be a big game player. Yeah, just for like, sure. I guess, obviously, I know the difference. I've played the sport and stuff like that, but why don't you run through, maybe first of all, even because I think that's probably the biggest thing that people don't even realize is the actual differences between the surfaces, clay, hard, and, you know, grass. And then maybe just like run through the top three things if you, you know, off the cuff, of what you would look for when you're capping a game.
Okay. So, I mean, and look, I would like you to chime in here because, for example, I haven't even set foot onto a clay court before. I'm assuming you have, right?
Yes.
But my, based on what I've read about a clay court, is that obviously the ball will travel a lot slower, and when it hits the surface, it will come up at a sharper angle than what it would on a grass or a hard court, allowing a person to set up his shots and effectively put more power and dedicate more time into those ground strokes.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
It's basically, in layman's terms, much harder to hit a winner. Mm. And then, so you talk about like a Suzanne Longong at Roland Garros or Keito, or I'm trying to think of some of these really hard. And like, it's funny because it's so ridiculous. You'd think that every clay court has the same speed.
Yeah, no.
It's not the case.
Yep.
Like, ATP Houston used to be played on a US type of clay court, and that thing flies, mate. Like, it could be as fast as a slow hard in Acapulco. Like, it doesn't make any sense. So,
the same tournament can be a different speed from year to year. Mm-hmm. Like, we saw it with some of the Grand Slams. They're
Aussie
like,
Open.
We're not getting any rallies. It's not entertaining for the fans. Let's slow the fuck out of these courts, you know?
Like, when you check the numbers from after a tournament, and normally it's hard to get those numbers during a tournament. You just have to listen to word of mouth and what the commentators are saying who are on the ground.
And but sometimes the players as well, because like you'll go, like you said, some of their Twitter accounts or Instagram accounts, or even like some of the journos or whatever, they'll say like, these courts are playing way slower than last year, you know, and they'll know in the first couple of days.
Yeah. So yeah, no, just back to it. Like you've got a clay court, which is a slow surface. The ball isn't traveling incredibly quickly, which is giving guys who like the grind and sort of air towards the side of fitness-based, mentally tough tennis.
Yep.
Example, Rafael Nadal. There's no wonder why the bloke's won a squillion clay court titles. It's because he's somebody that is incredibly hard to break down. He's never going to give up and just cherishes that extra time to put a lot of boom into his shots.
Yeah, yeah.
That top spin forehand. And you look at a guy like Nick Kyrgios, I think the tape is pretty clear that he's most comfortable, plays his best tennis on grass, if not a very quick hard.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's because he doesn't want to be taking part in rallies that are longer than 7 or 8 shots.
Yeah, that's right.
Or maybe 3 shots. So, and then in between that, you've got the hard court stuff. I mean, and people, even I think maybe 2 years ago from now, I was talking to one of my mates who's a pretty sharp tennis guy, and I said, hey, you know, he's playing on the hard court this weekend. He played on the hard court last week, and he said, yeah, but last week it was an outdoor hard. Mm. This week it's an indoor hard.
Totally different,
It's crazy though, right?
You've got
guys who the wind will annoy them.
Yep.
Really badly, especially servers. You think Ivo Karlovic wants to go play in Dubai,
30-mile-an-hour
wind, and throw it up and have, like, everything, mate. So
100%.
All the elements are so crucial. Cannot be overstated. Yeah, so it's
you made
and that's one of the factors,
the
biggest ones, really.
100%. You made a good point. Like I played college tennis over in America, and I lived in a place where there was, you know, it got really hot in the summer and we had snow in the winter, so we had outdoor courts for the summer, right? But we also had indoor courts in what was basically an inflatable bubble, and the courts played completely differently. And so if we ever had to play, you know, a team that possibly would prefer the indoor bubble courts, and it was like summer, we just say, oh, we'll move it outdoors, you know, we'll play you guys outdoors. Or vice versa, you know. I wanted to get onto, you're probably most famous in the group, honestly, for some of your futures plays that you've had lately. And look, as an, you know, an NRL punter, an NFL punter mainly, generally we'd sort of say that, you know, it's so tough to find value in futures markets because there's 20-odd options and the bookie edge is about 20% on some of those futures, you know? But you seem to be able to pretty consistently find some value in the futures. Just run us through your basic process there.
Oh, look, I'd be lying if I said I haven't been quite fortunate. But, I mean, people say that to me, but you do make your own luck. Maybe a dozen of these in the last 12 months, maybe more. And I don't know, man, like, this is where it gets really tricky for me mentally, because people say to me, look, you find value, you find a number that you think should be over, and you play it no matter what.
Yep.
But like, and I'm always bouncing in my own head about this, because sometimes I will see a guy at over the odds. I'll use an example. About 3 weeks ago, I posted in the Tripod group a futures bet on Pablo Carreño Busta, who was paying $12 to win at Antwerp. And as a number one seed, if you're a half-decent prospect at an ATP 250, you shouldn't be that high.
Right.
You shouldn't be $12.
You should be top 10? Than 4, 5, he'd be top 6. 10 player?
He'd be, I think, somewhere between 17 and 25. He's I don't think he's top 10, Busta. Late teens, maybe.
Yep.
But more importantly than his ranking, his seeding at this tournament, he's number one, right?
Yeah,
and you know that he shouldn't be $12. But I also know in my head that I don't actually think Buster has what it takes at this point in the season to have a sustained run and win this tournament. But I still knew that $12 was over. So that's where like a cash out scenario will come into it where, I'll, for example, I put $1,000 on Buster. He immediately dropped to $3.50, which was unders. It was a bit of a panic move from Neds.
Yeah. And then that, you never see that. That's a crazy move, yeah.
And then 350 is unders, and I know it's unders because rewinding, like as soon as the draw comes, like on Twitter, I will know when the draw ceremony is and when the draw release is. So okay. I will see the draw about maybe 2 or 3 hours before Bet365 will trade it and release it and stuff like that.
Do they release odds for a tournament before the draw's been released?
No, they wait. I'm able, unless it's a major.
Right.
Of course, but these little ones. But like, I guess what I'm saying is I'll see a draw ceremony and know who's seeded one to however many. And then in that 2 hour, 3 hour window between when the draw's released and when Bet365 releases odds on it, I'll have my odds for every single play in that draw in front of me.
Yeah, right.
So that when that draw inevitably comes out, and usually it's first on Sportsbet, I will know really quickly whether or not my odds match up with what is there,
yep.
Right? And that's how I'll often just know when to pounce on a guy and smash them. And if I get overs initially, that's great. I can catch out. Like, the world's my oyster. I can do whatever I want. But sometimes, for me, it has to be a combination of overs and do I genuinely like the individual? You know what I mean? Because and this is where it becomes really hard to explain, because some people blindly want to bet value, and as soon as they secure that value and as soon as they see it, they're betting it and they're closing their eyes and that's it.
Yep.
But I personally can't do it that way. For me, I need to actually have respect and have faith in that particular player that they're actually going to be able to go on a sustained run
and
win the thing. Like, I'll use one example. My biggest futures hit this year was Laszlo Gera at ATP Sardinia. I got him between 34 and 41 to win that 250 in Italy. I thought he was truly about a $12 or $13 shot.
Okay, But
even then, in my head, that's still less than a 10% proposition, right? You're probably better at maths than me.
It's like 8% or whatever, that. Yeah.
So if someone held a gun to my head, I wouldn't bet my mum's life on him winning the tournament. But I did think I had significant overs. Then I get the overs and the odds shortened in, and I could have cashed out for whatever figure I wanted to. It was a really good figure. And in the past, with a guy like Buster or a guy, someone else who I just wanted to score overs on then bail, I might have taken the number. But I actually saw the draw. I love the draw. I love how undervalued he is, and I love the way he plays his tennis.
Yep.
And I rode with that. And in the last 12 months, It almost seems like everyone that I've cashed out on after securing overs pre-tournament has lost.
Yeah,
and everyone that I've ridden with has won.
That's what you hope for.
And bloody oath, mate. And I know I don't want to sit here and big note myself and say I've been that lucky, but I have been really fortunate. And again, it's not something that just happens. It's hours and hours of dedication, figuring out where these guys are actually at leading into the tournament, what they've been up to.
100%.
Are they ready for a run? All that kind of stuff. Because
I was going to say as well, like, just as, like, simplistically, like, so you said you got that bloke at, you know, you thought fair value was $12. He was up, you know, around the 40. Just thinking, like,
if,
when you're making the decision, let's say, to cash out pre-tournament, let's say, before the tournament even starts, let's say you assign him a value of $12, you think that's fair. Would you basically say, like, if his odds drop from 40 to 20 pre-tournament, you'd be like, I won't cash out? Or if it actually drops below what you think is fair value, then you start to think, okay, you know, is that kind of
good question? A decent good question. View? Yeah. So I've generated such a good feel of the cash out function on Bet365 or whatever. I'll just know. That if that cash out price is overs, then I wouldn't ever be too dumb to not take it.
Yes,
if that makes sense. Like, if I had him graded at 12s, I got him at 41s, and then he dropped to 8s, and that cash out figure was just incredibly appealing, then truthfully, I'm probably taking it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm probably taking it and saying, look, fellas, we've just made times down money by God knows how much. We'll take that. I mean, if he goes on to win, we've got egg in our face, but at least we've taken a really good
figure. That's what a better wants is, like, less variability, you know, and I guess that's what you're getting if you're getting pre-game and cashing out. It's like less variance in your ups and downs, I guess.
And just one more thing. People always talk about, like, taking a futures market. You compare the outright price to what the return would be if you just continually rolled over that prospect. Right, you would know what I'm talking about, right? And And people often roll over that prospect at worst case scenario. So they'll match him up against the sixth seed. They'll match him up against the best.
If all the best seeds go through. Yep.
Never happens, mate. And, right. and never at these crappy tournaments when people don't want to be present.
Yep.
So you say, yeah, look, I might be selling myself short if he comes up against, you know, if he comes up against Rafa, Dominic Thiem, Stefanos Tsitsipas. Maybe. I mean, guys like that normally aren't bailing out early. But at a smaller tournament, the seeds are always dropping and they're coming up against qualifiers. And it's like, so that's all well and good to say, hey, would you be doing better rolling him over? But as soon as one crucial scalp goes, mate, it's like you're kicking yourself that you didn't just bet the futures as soon as that happens. So it's always futures for me. It's one or two guys, usually one guy. And if I'm keen on him from a value standpoint and from a spot standpoint, then we'll ride him all the way to the final unless we get a cash out figure that's just at well overs before he swings a racket. So.
No, that totally makes sense. I wanted to hit you up with one last question, and it was actually Jacob that was interested in this one. You don't have to obviously say what your normal stake size would be for an individual game, but like you said, you know, sometimes you'll see a futures play that's way too high, you've got a feeling it's going to drop, and you'll probably be able to cash out for a profit before the tournament starts. Would you say that if you think that's the case, that you'll be able to cash out before the tournament for, you know, little to no risk, would you say that your stake would be way larger than a regular bet? Yeah.
Yes.
Like, you know, 5x or something like that. Yeah.
Yes. If the cash out symbol's there and I know that I'm right, and like when I'm competing with Sportsbet, for example, they tend to be a little bit incompetent when they're doing these tennis markets. They seem to be the most off the mark bookies on a consistent basis. If I'm competing against them and I know that they've got a guy who's just miles over the odds, I'll max bet it. I'll bet as much as I can. And the same goes with any bookie. If I feel like I've got, because at the very worst, it's where it should be. I'm never betting on unders. You know what I mean? So, and if it's if I know I can cash out pre-tournament, which using Bet365 as an example, incredible cash out function, the best in Australia by far.
Yep.
It's always reliable. I know I'm going to be able to take the figure. I will bet as much as I can bet.
Yeah, fair enough. Mate, thanks for joining us. Obviously, good luck with your current bets. And where can people find your tips and insights if they're trying to find you?
Well, basically the way I do it is I've just got a WhatsApp group where I've got two groups. One's a tips only group and one's a chat only group. And basically that just allows me to get in really, really quickly if I'm not able to post. But I'd say 80% of what I'm doing is in the tripod group. But there's those little gems that I can't get in sometimes at 11 p.m. or 1 a.m. So I've got the WhatsApp chat there. And the way you can get into that is just contact me and I'll send you a link. You can join the chat or you can just join the tips and keep an eye on the chat and a tripod as well, because I'll be bouncing around both.
Perfect, mate. Sounds good. Well, thanks again for joining us. Awesome insight. And I'm sure we'll have you on again. Cheers again.
Excellent. Cheers, mate. Thank you.
Thanks, buddy.
Bye.